Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Liberal justices on the state Supreme Court signal they're open to overturning a ban on ballot drop boxes. We break down what else happened during oral arguments. Plus, things get heated during a debate on a series of veto overrides in the state Senate. And we preview what you can expect during Republican state convention this weekend in Appleton. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for May 17th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We're going to talk with the fate of absentee ballot drop boxes in our state as the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments on this issue, which comes just 2 years after they already visited this issue and deemed them illegal. But, of course, the court's makeup has changed quite a bit. So let's begin with that. Liberal justices who now control the court showed signs that they were willing to overhaul the ban on absentee ballot drop boxes during oral arguments on Monday. Now, the lawsuit, which is backed by Democrats, seeks to overturn, like I mentioned, a 2022 ruling that prohibited voters from using drop boxes unless they were placed right at the municipal clerk's office and they were monitoring them. During arguments, we heard from both sides, mainly conservatives, say that, hey, we already just listened to this case. We shouldn't have to revisit this right now. Meanwhile, liberal justices seemed pretty willing to reverse this decision. So let's hear arguments from both sides from Monday in the courtroom.
In Teigen, what if we just got it wrong? What if we made a mistake? Are we now supposed to just perpetuate that mistake into the future?
There were things that were not put up before this court, and if they had been put before this court, the court would have reached a different decision. I am not aware of any other statutory case in this court's history or in the U.S. Supreme Court's history where there were no new legal arguments presented, no factual developments presented, and no claim that law has changed, and yet the meaning of a statute was changed.
You are asking this court to become a super legislature and give free rein, despite what the statutes say, give free rein to municipal clerks to conduct elections however they see fit. That, counsel, seems to me to be the greater danger to democracy, because you're asking this court to override what the legislature wrote.
We are not. We are asking the court to apply the statutes that the legislature wrote according to the text of those statutes and this court's settled approach to stare decisis and statutory interpretation.
Now, we don't know when they're going to make a ruling on this decision, but it could carry some weight, of course, because we have just months away from the August primary, and then we have the November election. And, you know, given if this is overturned, it could possibly have an impact on voter turnout this fall.
Yeah, so stare decisis, not a Latin expert, but it means basically adhering to precedent. And there are exceptions to that rule that for the courts of when you can ignore precedent. Jill Karofsky laid out basically when the case that we should ignore precedent in Wisconsin because the case was wrongly decided, it's had an impact, and these other factors. The second thing I'm watching this whole thing is how far does the court go with this decision? So let's operate for the time being on the assumption that they'll overturn the ruling from 2022 and allow drop boxes. Will it be a narrow decision, say drop boxes are okay, and that's it? Or will it grant wider authority to clerks saying, we're going to leave it to your discretion of what you can do, which is what Rebecca Bradley is bringing up. Okay, what's the limit going to be? Go back to 2020, Democracy in the Park, where the Madison clerk had paid employees in the park collecting absentee ballots. Is that going to be okay? Racine, there's a lawsuit before the court right now about this mobile voting van where they used a van to go around to early voting in the August 22 primary. Is that going to be allowed? Well, if you follow the court's trajectory of, you know, the whole drop box thing before in 2022 was state law doesn't expressly authorize drop boxes. It says not expressly authorize, ergo it's not legal. The Racine case, the Racine County judge, in that decision cited called the Teigen ruling from 2022 multiple times, saying state law does not expressly authorize these mobile voting vans, ergo it's not allowed. Well, if the court says it's not about what's expressly authorized, but the clerk's discretion, you would think that mobile voting van is going to be allowed when that case gets decided sometime later this year. And the question again becomes, where else does the court go with this? So that's what I'm watching. It's not just the overturning the ballot box ban, which we assume they're going to do, but how wide is that decision written and what's it allow come November.
Right, and if they don't write additional policies in place, do we see other lawsuits being filed about what should be allowed for clerks to be able to do with these absentee ballot drop boxes? And if they are implemented for the election, we know there's this big push by Republicans right now, vote early, vote early, vote absentee. Meanwhile, you have the former president when he visits here in Wisconsin and on the campaign trail saying otherwise. Last time he was in Waukesha, he was saying he wants one-day voting by paper ballot. So he's still pushing a different message where we're seeing a lot of Republicans, state and national ones, trying to get their base together and say, hey, things could go wrong on Election Day. We know the weather in Wisconsin sometimes in November isn't too pleasant. So we'll see what happens with that, too. It's keep an eye on.
Impact-wise, remember, in 2020, 3.3 million people voted in Wisconsin. Like 2 million votes were cast absentee. In 2022, it was 1 million, so which is still a lot. I mean, don't get me wrong.
There was also a pandemic and then kind of eased out, yeah.
But what I'm getting at is we're moving back toward more normal. So there are people still like the convenience of voting absentee. I don't know if this is going to have a wide impact on the turnout this fall or how many votes are cast. But Karas could bring up, in 2020, there were like, 689 votes that came in late when we had drop boxes. In 2022, there was like twice as many or more than that, even though we had fewer absentee ballots cast, suggesting that lacking drop boxes led to more people mailing them. The mail has not been very fast lately, if I've noticed. So, and in Wisconsin, we're 22,000 votes can decide a presidential election. Maybe every little bit helps, so we'll see.
And there was a bill that could possibly speed up the process, the Monday count bill that was with bipartisan support, passed the Assembly. Likely, very unlikely to get a vote in the Senate that some clerks would believe speed up some election results. All right, let's move on to recapping the Senate session that was on Tuesday. We're going to get to what was discussed, but we're going to start how it ended because it briefly descended in a little bit of a chaos. Yeah. We had Senator Tim Carpenter throw his papers up in the air kind of towards Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue because this was all over their attempt to try to get some amendments on the floor, and it was abruptly ended because there was someone that needed to catch a plane from the Republican caucus. You know, when you're in the majority, you set the rules, you can end this. We've seen this kind of happen before, these disputes. Now that we've briefly discussed that, Jared, let's get to what was actually on the floor of debate. There was nine bills that Senate Republicans overrid that were previously rejected by Governor Tony Evers. We're talking about things that address PFAS pollution, known as forever chemicals found in some water and groundwater and other household products. And then there was also bills that would expand teacher apprenticeship programs, and two election bills. One would mandate audits of elections, and another would put on someone's driver's license or ID that they are a non-U.S. citizen. I'm bringing up that bill specific because it will lead into Senator Tim Carpenter talking about that bill. He, quote, called it garbage, some of the rhetoric that he believed his colleagues were talking about on the floor. Meanwhile, there was a passionate speech by Senator Mary Falskowski about PFAS solutions, and it was just, once again, finger-pointing debate on the floor. So let's talk, hear from both of them real quick before we dive into the details of what happened.
I represent a district, as I said before, that has the highest concentration of Latinos of any other Senate district. And this thing about people passing out election flyers at the border to go vote for the Democrats is a bunch of bull. People are so paranoid and schizophrenic about elections, they're willing to do almost everything to be punitive for people. It's disgusting to serve in a body with people with the garbage that I'm hearing, attacking a group of people, trying to drive them underground when they have voters' rights.
PFAS is entering young women's eggs, knowing it causes cancer, as my colleague so eloquently stated, and then having the audacity to say that Republicans are playing games with people's lives. This is a political chess game for the Democrats and the governor. You're playing with people's lives and their investments and their families. And it's time to stop.
So what they did, of course, was override these vetoes, but the Assembly appears not interested in coming back. They also don't have a supermajority. It's also now been 39 years since there's been a successful veto override, according to LRB, when I asked them about it. That means we haven't really seen one successful since 1985. So what we're trying to get at, JR, is that it's pretty much more about political messaging when they go back to their districts.
Yeah, messaging and teeing up a possible action in the Assembly. So with the messaging piece, let's look at the bills. So the PFAS bill, there have been some members put in a box about this. The hospital funding up in northwestern Wisconsin, they're playing defense on that. One of the bills about, you know, basically police looking into use of force, maybe an anti-law vote against Brad Paff when he's up for election this fall. You know, in the mail pieces when they have those, you know, really inflammatory headlines and there's a little tiny type that says roll call vote XXX on certain date, that gets you there. So a little bit of that. But then looking forward to the Assembly, Robin Voss has not, as far as I know, talked publicly about this. Devin Lemieux, whenever he asked him, has said he did not talk to Robin. He talked to Robin a little bit, but had no guarantee they were going to come back. The math is not in Robin's favor right now. However, it's 64-35. You need 66 votes override. But Maricel Cabrera, like a judge this spring, she'll resign by August 1st. Okay, that knocks it down one. There's a special election now in the 4th Senate District. Two members of the Assembly are running, Dora Drake, Keisha Myers. Either wins, will have to resign, take that seat. That takes it down two. You go from 66 votes for override down to 65 at 97 members. That means every Democrat in the Assembly is the deciding vote in every veto override. If there's a member of the Assembly who's on vacation, now that would drop it even more. Now, here's the thing, though. You have to go through extraordinary session to come back into a veto override, which means 24 hours notice. You also have to have all your members come in if you're Robin Voss. Angie Sapik up in northern Wisconsin, freshman Republican, quite a haul from where she lives. She got drawn into a 60% plus Dem district by Republicans as they embrace the Evers map. Will she have the incentive to come down to vote on X, Y, and Z? A lot of these bills aren't really big movers in terms of like changing policy in Wisconsin. Now, they did, besides what happened this week, they did override in the Senate governor's veto of a tax cut. That's a big deal. Maybe there's incentive there. But remember, the session doesn't end until like right in early January. They've come back in December before. If Robin Voss saw an opportunity to score a win and take one over, get one over on Tony Evers, especially ending the veto streak, people are sure he would do it. The question is, do they have the people and the appetite to come in, and when could they do it?
So if you're a Democrat and you're planning to travel internationally, maybe keep it to yourself and don't let any of the Republicans find out. All right, well, let's move on to our next topic, which kind of continues the conversation over PFAS specifically, because this week Evers did sue over the continuous PFAS fight between him and Republicans and part of a reading program and some other things. So what this lawsuit targets is what you're seeing on your screen. It's still that $125 million to fight PFAS contaminants, $15 million to respond to the hospital closures in western Wisconsin, which you were mentioning earlier, JR, and nearly $50 million to help improve reading outcomes and literacy in K-12 schools. Now, the governor is arguing that, hey, all this money, which has already been approved, is just sitting there. You guys got to act on it. But once again, this is an example of how Republicans are trying to hold on to their power, that if they don't like the plans of how to spend it, they're going to say no because they want to have a say in it.
So Republicans, there's competing lawsuits over the place about vetoes right now.
Very true.
And spending. One of them is this lawsuit by Republicans saying that the governor sees authority with the literacy bill. Governors can use a partial veto authority only if it's an appropriations bill. The governor used that power on a bill that dictates how the money is spent. The money, though, is somewhere else. Republicans argue, therefore, it's not an appropriations bill. The governor shouldn't have been able to do that. Governor filed a counterclaim this week, basically the same argument we've seen from before of they're exercising a legislative veto, that they're allowing the Joint Finance Committee to hold on to this money and not release it. It's not appropriate, and we want you, the courts, to force them to start playing by what we think the rules should be. It's not going to be resolved anytime soon, but we'll be in court for a while on this and other issues.
All right. We're also going to move on to a bill that has been introduced for the past 3 years, but carries a little bit more weight. And I'm talking about it this week because it's about a task force, a bipartisan bill that would create a task force on missing and murdered Black and women and girls. Now, this comes shortly after the murder of Sade Robinson in Milwaukee. And Sade Robinson's family was actually at a court appearance the same day this press conference was held for Maxwell Anderson, who was accused of dismembering her body. And we've unfortunately found body parts now in Illinois. This is an ongoing case, and Anderson has pleaded not guilty. So while that was going on, she had some representatives from her family there talking about it, and others from the Racine area, Milwaukee, all speaking out about this bill. So there was activists, community members, families of victims, basically urging the state Senate to take up this bill. And this was one that wasn't on Democrats' list that they were trying to bring forth, but they still are trying to find an avenue to do that. But without Republicans, they can't get it on the floor. So what this bill would do, it would study some of what, you know, root causes behind the disproportionate murders of black women. Now, Senator Dewey Strobel, who's the bill, it originated in his committee recently, I would say in the past few weeks, moved it to another committee, and he was kind of the big opponent for it for a while. And his reasoning behind it is that he believes the attorney general can just do this on his own. The attorney general has already created a very similar task force for indigenous women and studying the impacts of them and some of the murders behind that. So this has kind of been the main argument from Democrats in saying, hey, AG, you can do it. Why aren't we doing it? And it seems that funding appears to be the issue, according to Representative Sheila Stubbs, who is the main author of the bill. Let's hear from Representative Stubbs first, and we'll dive a little bit more into this bill.
As a state, we have been silent on an issue for far too long. Today is the day it ends. I am concerned that despite this bill unanimously passing committee in both houses and the legislature and passing the assembly floor this session, this bill has yet to be given a floor date in the Senate. I can say to you from many conversations, funding is an issue. And at this point, I don't care that funding is an issue. I want something done now.
So the bill itself doesn't appropriate any resources. What I'm talking about is funding. So that is likely the issue and the holdup here. I did talk to a spokeswoman for the DOJ who said we're still working to try to find a solution. What that solution might be, we'll see. But it's likely it will maybe be something down the road that wouldn't be through legislation because, as we know, lawmakers have pretty much wrapped up their work for the year.
Yeah, just worth noting, Dewey Strobel has been representing a 70% Republican seat the last 2 years. Now is in a 52-ish Republican seat, a little bit of a lean versus deep red. He's a little more sensitive to some of these things he was before because he has a contested race on his hands. Jody Habersynikin, who ran in the special election last year for the Senate seat, is at back again, then hitting him on PFAS, hitting him on other issues, and you've seen him more vocal defending his decisions and his positions compared to maybe past years when he'd have to worry about an election.
All right, let's move on to the vice president being in Wisconsin again. I should say, of course, we're going to see many visits by her and the president and former president as well. So she was in Milwaukee this week touting the Biden administration's effort to help people of color deal with debt, particularly student loans and medical bills, while also creating economic opportunities like buying a home. And this, I would say this visit was a little bit different because she was on stage with a comedian in Milwaukee.
Dale Hewley, a comedian and radio show host, part of the outreach to black voters, voters of color, saying we are trying to do things to help you because look at the polls. President Biden got, I think, 90-some percent of the black vote in 2020. He is nowhere near that right now in the polls that we've seen. That's a problem. The coalition for Biden includes a number of different groups and voters. He has to have them all back together again this fall, or he's going to have a hard time. Here's a group of voters they're trying to bring back in the fold and get excited about his candidacy, because without them, they are in deep trouble.
Right, and this comes also on the heels of President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump agreeing to two debates. One will be in June, one will be in September. There was also announced dates today for a VP debate as well. But, of course, we don't know who Trump's running mate is yet, and no one has completely agreed to those dates yet. But it will be after the convention, which Trump has said he is very likely going to name his VP nominee in Milwaukee when he's on the stage.
Gotta build the drama.
I know, right? You got to. He loves to do that. All right, let's move on to the next topic, which we are going to be previewing, the state GOP convention. The state GOP convention that will be happening, which will kick off actually today, but all the big stuff is going to be happening tomorrow. Now, JNR, you and I will be there. Of course, you can watch it. It will be streamed on WizEye as well. This is kind of the opportunity where there's a lot of speeches. There'll be a legislative panel. There'll be a congressional panel. We'll also hear from U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde, who actually does not have an opponent. So usually there's, you know, the endorsement process. Usually sometimes we've seen candidates candidates duel it out? Well, there's not really going to be something like that. Before we dive into what else you can expect, earlier this week, newsmakers interviewed Brian Schimming, the chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, talking about basically the infrastructure right now compared to what the Biden team has. And what I mean by infrastructure is that the Biden team has a lot of people on the grounds right now, and it appears that the Trump campaign is a little bit behind. So Lisa asked about that, and let's take a listen real quick.
Last week, the Biden administration announced a major infrastructure investment in Wisconsin. They talked about 46 new offices, 80 full-time staff. They also knocked the Republican National Committee for closing a minority outreach office in Wisconsin. But the RNC, like you said, starting to build some infrastructure, hiring some people. But it's the optics look like you're pretty far behind. How do you expect to catch up, or is it a catch-up game?
Yeah, I don't consider it a catch-up game because we're following a plan that we've used in the past, including with Ron Johnson's victorious race, including with victorious, we had great victories across the state on April 2nd in the two referenda. So we'll be opening dozens of offices around the state. We're already staffing up pretty dramatically, actually. So they can put out their news releases about what they're doing all they want. But the truth is their cost per vote's pretty high. They dropped over $100 million on Ron Johnson and lost. And so I always tell people what's...
Money doesn't tell the whole story?
Money does not tell the whole story at all. And I mean, when you're only raising 3% of your money in state, that tells you something. And so it's interesting because in 2022, of course, there were high-profile, you know, governor and attorney general's races, but Ron Johnson got reelected, number one. Number two, we picked up a congressional seat in western Wisconsin that we had not held in 26 years, and we got vastly outspent there. Assembly, Senate seats, we took a supermajority in the Senate. So as I say, I kind of like my cost per vote, and they spend like crazy and still lose.
So what else are you watching for the convention this week, JR?
Messages. I talked to Brian Schimming as well. He says he's got a message of unity, that unity equals victory. There's going to be a race for National Committee Man, National Committee Woman. In the RNC, Republican National Committee, there are three members from each state. One's a state chair, and there's one for a man, one for a woman. Those elections are tomorrow. Interesting to see how those play out. Turning Point USA is a pro-Trump group, especially with Charlie Kirk, kind of targeting younger voters. Building its own kind of infrastructure in Wisconsin. They're trying to get toeholds in state parties around the country. There are some races shaping up as the Turning Point USA candidate versus the kind of longtime party activist candidate. Watching that. So it'll be an interesting debate convention, though not necessarily the pizzazz of maybe having Donald Trump come in like he's in Minnesota tonight for Lincoln Day dinner or having a VP nominee come in. But Byron Donalds is going to be speaking, one of Trump's surrogates. So I'm sure it's going to be Trump-heavy without Trump being there.
All right, let's get the stock picks this week. And rising this week is the 8th Congressional District. We're looking at fundraising and, of course, the announcement, or fundraising, excuse me, stick with fundraising.
So, interesting little quirk here with the governor's call. So, state law says if there's a vacancy in a House seat between the second Tuesday in April and second Tuesday in May, the vacancy shall be filled at the partisan election that year. That means the August primary and November general. Governor called that special election this week. It also means you have two different elections. To the FEC, that means two different fundraising caps. So right now, for a normal race for federal office, you can get $3,300 from a donor for the primary, the same amount for the general election. If you run in both the special and the regular election this fall for the 8th Congressional District, you can raise twice as much from a donor because you're running two different races. Now, you're not going to use it differently. It's all going to be for the same race, essentially. But it's an interesting quirk in what's going on. You also have twice as much work. You have to file two nomination papers. There's a worry about confusion. The Elections Commission met this week and talked about the ballot because we've been conditioned in Wisconsin and elsewhere that if you vote for one candidate in one race, period. How are voters going to react when they see two different spots for the 8th Congressional District, both in August and November, and are asked to vote two different times? How's that going to work? So they're talking about adding on to the ballot the dates of the term. So whoever wins a special election will be certified or can sworn in like the day after everything is certified and final. They'll take over and fill that spot from end of December through early January. The regular election is January of 25 through January of 27, trying to make that distinction known. Two, they're talking about an insert to go with absentee ballots or a flyer at the polling place to say, hey, This is what's going on.
And hey, it's not an error.
Yes.
Yes.
Worry about voter confusion. The other kind of interesting thing has been like this conspiracy theory from some conservatives that, oh, Governor Evers is trying to mess with this election. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I stress it all the time. But so I read state law, like he had to do this. Like this is the parameter for it. But there's this question of, does it benefit anybody? Like, is it going to help somebody to, you know, Kristen Lynott, the only Democrat running, is she going to get some boost from this? I don't think so from my conversations. I mean, it's a plus 10 or so Republican seat. They're not expecting to win. I don't know you're going to get, the other weird thing is you could have, in theory, somebody win the special election and somebody else win the general election. That's kind of a different one. Probably not going to happen if you're voting for Tony Weed, Roger Roth, or Andre Jacques on the Republican side, or Kristen Lynott on the Democratic side. You'll probably mark the same person both elections, but it's possible. Another quirk that's interesting is whoever wins a special election, if they win the normal election as well, they'll get a 40-day roughly head start on their fellow freshmen. Remember, the House and Senate are basically built on seniority. So when you pick offices, it's whoever's been the longest. Those 40 days matter when it comes to picking an office in January. You can also get your office going, hire staff, get established. So there's some benefit, but also more work for these candidates in the 8th Congressional District.
All right, let's get to Mix this week, and we're talking about the other special election, which is the 4th Senate District.
So the question is, what took so long? So remember, this has also been open since January. Lena Taylor became a circuit court judge back then. We've been waiting for a special election call ever since. Probably the maps has been the question. So remember, the Supreme Court back in December said you cannot use the maps of 2022 going forward, right? Okay. The maps that were signed by Governor Evers this year don't take effect until the fall. We're in no man's land. The Supreme Court was asked which map should be used and said, we're not going to tell you. The Elections Commission has been silent about this. And so Evers signed an executive order saying, we're using the maps that I signed. And his office says, we believe those maps are in place. They took effect the day after we signed them. Okay. The reality is, unless somebody sues, we don't know for sure.
We don't know, yeah.
But for Dorr and Lakeisha, they're running the special election. July 30th is the special election. July 2nd is the primary. July 2nd is what matters. It's a super Democratic seat. Whoever wins, done deal. The question, though, is if it had been earlier, they could have had a fallback of their assembly seat because now Dorr and Lakeisha, basically their careers, our political careers, at least right now, are on the line. Mm-hmm. If you win in July, great, you're in state Senate. If you lose, you can't go back and run for the assembly again. That's it, you're done. So it's a challenge for them. And oh, by the way, don't forget, they also have twice as much work. You're not guaranteed by winning in July that you'll win in November, or well, actually the August primary. So July 2nd primary is the basically the whole kit and caboodle for this seat. Then the August primary. So if you lose in July, you come back in August to win, it's more work for them, more fundraising, more pressure. So it's an interesting dynamic for the two of them.
Definitely. All right. And following this week is Mark Mohn, who is the UWM chancellor, kind of got in a spat with UW System President Jay Rothman over the protests.
Look, we've seen all kinds of protests around the country. We saw Madison how it handled its protest. The encampment went away. There was a deal announced by Milwaukee. A lot of similar provisions, the Madison one. But Mohney is getting ripped for a number of reasons. One, it seems like he didn't really communicate very well with the university leadership about what was going on. Two, there are a lot of Jewish donors and people in the Jewish community who are unhappy because they're accusing him of refusing to meet with Jewish students. As we've seen, the cause by these pro-Palestinian protesters saying, hey, we need to pay more attention to that. There's also this concern about anti-Semitism and Jewish students feeling unhappy and uncomfortable on campus. Mohney is accused of not meeting with those students. That's not a good thing to do. Two, there's vandalism on campus. The library that's named for the first female Israeli prime minister who was a student at Milwaukee before it was Milwaukee, the old name, that was vandalized. There's concern they're getting off scot-free, the students who did this kind of stuff. Everything about this agreement has been criticized as, example, going too far, like giving too much away. Mohney's had sometimes an interesting relationship with the leadership at campus. So my question is, or the system, does this affect his job security? These are at-will positions. Is this going to be one thing too many where leadership goes, we have a problem here? That's what I'm watching for going forward.
All right. Well, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association. the voice of real estate.